Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, well, you're in for a treat today. Today's episode is my greatest hits episode number 10. Another landmark in Just for the Health of It. This features timely and timeless stories from April through July of 2022. Okay, well, let's get rolling with a few stories from a topic near and dear to my heart, nutrition. This from Medical Express. New article outlines the characteristics of a, quote, longevity diet. The authors report that the key characteristics of the optimal diet appear to be moderate to high carbohydrate intake from non-refined sources, low but sufficient protein from largely plant-based sources, and enough plant-based fats to provide about 30% of energy needs. Ideally, the day's meals would all occur within a window of 11 to 12 hours, allowing for a daily period of fasting, and a five-day cycle of fasting or fast-mimicking diet every 3 to 4 months may also help reduce insulin resistance, blood pressure, and other risk factors for individuals with increased disease risk. They describe what eating for longevity could look like in real life. Lots of legumes, that's beans, peas, and lentils, whole grains, and vegetables, some fish, no red meat or processed meat, and very low white meat, low sugar and refined grains, good levels of nuts and olive oil, and some dark chocolate. I appreciate that last one being added in there, since that's one of my favorite little treats. Once or twice a day is a little square of 85% or more dark chocolate. This next story is also from Medical Express. New expert consensus statement published on achieving remission of type 2 diabetes using diet as a primary intervention. The American College of Lifestyle Medicine has released an expert consensus statement to assist clinicians in achieving remission of type 2 diabetes in adults using diet as a primary intervention. The expert consensus statement is endorsed by the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, supported by the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and co-sponsored by the Endocrine Society. This unique publication in the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine is the first to focus on diet as primary means of achieving lasting remission of diabetes without medications or procedures, in contrast with the usual role of diet as an adjunctive therapy. Knowing that diet alone can achieve remission is an empowering message for many adults with type 2 diabetes, especially when supported by consensus among internists, cardiologists, family physicians, endocrinologists, nutritionists, dietitians, and lifestyle medicine specialists. Diet as a primary intervention was considered most effective when emphasizing whole plant-based food, including whole grains, vegetables, legumes, fruits, nuts, and seeds. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because that's probably the most healthy diet for just about everything. Whole, plant-based foods, including whole grains, vegetables, legumes, fruits, nuts, and seeds. Okay. It is essential to reduce the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, which is estimated to affect almost 11% of U.S. adults and costs $327 billion annually in direct costs and decreased productivity. Without adequate treatment and management, the condition can result in blindness, kidney disease, cardiovascular disease, amputation, and other comorbidities that diminish quality of life and contribute to mortality rates. Okay, well, a whole foods plant-based diet, sometimes referred to as a vegan diet, but slightly different. It focuses more on the quality of food than whether it's plant or animal. can address a myriad of health problems. This next story from Medical Express as well gets to that. Vegan diet eases arthritis pain, finds new study. A low-fat vegan diet without calorie restrictions improves joint pain in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, according to a new study conducted by researchers at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and published in the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine. Study participants also experienced weight loss and improved cholesterol levels. A plant-based diet could be the prescription to alleviate joint pain for millions of people suffering from rheumatoid arthritis, says Neil Bernard, lead author of the study. And all of the side effects, including weight loss and lower cholesterol, are only beneficial. Rheumatoid arthritis is a common autoimmune disease that typically causes joint pain, swelling, and eventually permanent joint damage. Note that actually it's only, I think it's less than 20% of the people that have arthritis have rheumatoid, which is a more inflammatory form of arthritis. Osteoarthritis, which is the most common type of arthritis, this doesn't speak to that, but that's often a product of disuse, meaning move it or lose it. Exercise can help prevent the effects of osteoarthritis. Okay, well, next up, I'd like to switch to a story more about food in general. This from Food Politics. The U.S. is soon to become a net food importer, says the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Within the next year or so, the United States will be a net importer of agricultural products. So, you know, the United States for many generations has been known as the breadbasket of the world, exporting a lot of agricultural products, particularly grains. Well, folks, imminently, we will soon be a net importer of food, meaning that we take in more food from around the world than we export to. Way to go, United States. Integrated with the United States, but being perhaps a little too dependent for our own good. But after all, we are known for being big consumers. Okay, and spoiler alert for this story, since this is a greatest hit show, that story was from and aired over a year ago. So in fact, I expect that now the United States is in fact a net food importer. Okay, well, next up, let's go globally and put things in perspective in this country, as even eating or cooking specifically can be a complication to health and other factors that us in the first world may not have to deal with. This from Science Daily. Worlds vulnerable are being polluted in their own homes as they cook. 3/4 of kitchens in low-income homes across 12 major global cities are heavily polluted by cooking emissions, according to research from the University of Surrey and its global partners. The first-of-its-kind study found that poor ventilation and fuel choices were the most significant contributors to poor air quality in people's kitchens. But the size of the kitchen and the way food was cooked also mattered. Frying food led to particularly high levels of indoor pollution. There's a notable wealth divide when it comes to indoor air quality, and also a gender divide, as women are typically disproportionately impacted by pollution caused by cooking, especially in the developing world. This problem must be addressed to improve health and equality. The World Health Organization estimates that approximately 4 million people die prematurely from illnesses attributed to indoor air pollution caused by polluting stoves, operating on solid fuels, and kerosene. Exposure to high levels of particulate matter, including that from cooking, has been linked to health conditions including heart disease, pneumonia, stroke, lung cancer, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And while that may not affect a lot of us in this country, one personal tip I suppose you could take from that is fry foods less, because that produces a lot of the indoor air pollution and is usually a pretty good nutritional indicator as well. Okay, well, next up, I want to put global health in even larger context and recognize that patriarchy lives on. It's a rich white man's world. This from NPR. Men, especially from rich countries, still fill the boards of global health groups. The world of global health leadership is still very much a man's world. That's the conclusion of a new report published by Global Health 5050. The title, Boards for All? The report looked at the gender and geography of more than 2,000 board members across 146 global health organizations. Among the findings, only 25% of those seats were held by people from low and middle income countries, despite these countries being home to 83% of the world's population. Only 1% of board members were women from low-income countries. Nearly half the organizations evaluated had boards composed entirely of people from high-income countries. That's half of them. Yikes. I knew there was inequality, but the magnitude of it was shocking, said Dr. Catherine Kiyobutunga, executive director of the African Population and Health Research Center. For example, the statistic that more than 880 board seats out of 2,000 are occupied by Americans. That's 44% from one single country. How is that possible? This illustrates how bad the system is. This is not really global health.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, while Americans may be dominating global health, we don't even seem to manage to do a particularly good job even with our own people. Okay, well, the United States pays about double for our health care than compared to other Western industrialized countries that have universal health care. Are we getting our money's worth? Well, this first story and some that follow, we'll get to that. This first up from Medical Express. High cost of cancer care in the U.S. doesn't reduce mortality rates. There's a common perception in the U.S. that the U.S. offers the most advanced cancer care in the world, said lead author Ryan Chow at Yale. Our system is touted for developing new treatments and getting them to patients more quickly than other countries. We were curious whether the substantial U.S. investment on cancer care is indeed associated with better cancer outcomes. Out of the 22 high-income countries included in the study, the United States had the highest spending rate. The U.S. is spending over $200 billion per year on cancer care, roughly $600 per person, in comparison to the average of $300 per person across other high-income countries. This raises the key question, are we getting our money's worth? The researchers found that national care spending showed no relationship to population-level cancer mortality rates. In other words, countries that spend more on cancer care do not necessarily have better cancer outcomes. Smoking is the strongest risk factor for cancer mortality, and smoking rates have historically been lower in the United States compared to other countries. When the researchers controlled for international variations in smoking rates, U.S. cancer mortality rates were no different than the average high-income country. So, spending double doesn't seem to be getting us any more. And this sentence here particularly is illustrative of comparing public health versus medical care. The researchers found that national care spending showed no relationship to population-level cancer mortality rates. In other words, there's a lot of other things at the population level that public health is concerned about that is outside of the purview of individual healthcare and the healthcare system. Okay, well, that story was on cancer, the number two killer in the United States. How about the number one killer, heart disease? This from Science Daily. Heart attack mortality rate higher in the U.S. compared to other high-income countries. When it comes to treating heart attacks, U.S. hospitals may have the latest tech and low readmission rates, but the country's mortality rate is one of the highest among the nations included in a new study. The study, published in the British Medical Journal, found substantial differences in care for heart attack patients across six high-income countries despite international agreement on how heart attacks should be treated. The countries they compared were the United States, Canada, England, Netherlands, Israel, and Taiwan. Researchers showed chose those countries because they all have highly developed healthcare systems and accessible administrative data, but they differ in their financing, organization, and overall performance in international rankings. Researchers chose to look at heart attacks, a common condition with established international diagnostic criteria and consensus about evidence-based treatments that is easy to track with widely available data. From a U.S. perspective, our heart attack care is good, but the one-year mortality rate is concerning. If dying is the one thing we want to prevent, then we have work to do. So it just gets at that fact that we tend to be more procedure-focused, so we're real good at treatment with procedures, but if you're looking at the whole person, we're not actually so great at keeping you alive.
And now, for a word from our lack of sponsors, PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
And just when you think it can't get worse, look at mental health and how we deal with it in the United States, perhaps one of the worst ways possible. This from The Atlantic. Locking people up is no way to treat mental illness. The failure in services for people with mental illness and behavioral disorders associated with substance use have resulted in mass incarceration becoming the country's de facto mental health care system. People with mental illnesses in the United States are 10 times more likely to be incarcerated than they are to be hospitalized. Those who don't end up in prison are likely to cycle repeatedly through patchy psychiatric care, spells of homelessness, and emergency rooms. And every year, about 2 million arrests are made of people with serious mental illnesses. As a result, the makeup of our prison population tells its own tale. More than 70% of people in American jails and prisons have at least one diagnosed mental illness or substance use disorder, or both. Up to a third of those incarcerated have serious mental illnesses, a much higher rate than is found in at large. On any given day, approximately 380,000 people with mental illnesses are in jail or prison across the United States, and another 574,000 are under some form of correctional supervision. Aside from the human costs, the fiscal impact is astronomical. For example, Miami-Dade County currently spends $636,000 a day, or $232 million a year, to warehouse approximately 2,400 people with mental illnesses in its jail. In shocking contrast, the entire state of Florida spends only $47 million annually to provide mental health services to about 34,000 people in Miami, Dade, and Monroe counties. And this expenditure leaves almost 70,000 people in those counties with no access whatsoever to mental health services. So let's do that comparison. For jails, $232 million. For mental health care, $47 million. Shocking. That disjunction is typical. Most states spend far more tax dollars incarcerating people with mental illnesses than treating them. And this spending doesn't even reflect the exorbitant cost of treating comorbidities. People with serious mental illnesses have higher rates of heart disease and cancer than people without psychiatric issues. They are more likely to be admitted to hospitals and stay longer, and are less likely to have insurance. This situation is particularly shameful because proper treatment can work. Reform should begin by tackling mental and substance use disorders not as criminal behavior, but as illnesses. Arrest and incarceration should be the very last resort for people with serious behavioral health issues. We need to apply a public health model to the criminal justice system rather than a criminal justice model to the behavioral health system. We should not forget that law enforcement officers themselves are far from immune. Various studies have reported their rate of post-traumatic stress disorder to be from 15 to 35%, compared with 3.5% for the public generally. Last year, more law enforcement officers died by suicide than in the line of duty. There you go, people. I reported on this before, but yikes. So a police officer is more likely to kill themselves than by killed by somebody else in the line of duty. Law enforcement officers also experience high rates of substance abuse disorders. Mental health treatment should be made available to every law enforcement officer outside their department to ensure confidentiality and encourage take-up. So again, a clarion call to deal with health issues as a public health issue rather than as a law enforcement or criminal justice issue. Okay, well, next up, I have another mental health story. We know that depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide, but there is another looming problem that may be even bigger. This from Science Daily. U.S. civilian and military populations combined for more than $230 billion in annual costs for PTSD. A new study finds that the national economic burden of PTSD goes beyond direct healthcare expenses and exceeds the costs of other common mental health conditions such as anxiety and depression. The researchers estimated the cost of PTSD at $232 billion for 2018, the latest year for which data were available at the time of the study. They called for increased awareness of PTSD, more effective therapies, and the expansion of evidence-based strategies to reduce the large clinical and economic burden of that mental health condition. PTSD symptoms are well documented, re-experiencing the trauma through flashbacks and nightmares, avoidance of reminders of a traumatic event, changes in thoughts and feelings, such as guilt and emotional numbing, insomnia, and hyperarousal. In the study, the investigators brought to light the extent to which PTSD not only impacts veterans, but civilians as well. The research team found that civilians accounted for 82% of the total PTSD costs, compared with 18% for the military population. That disparity is predicated on the fact that the number of civilians far exceeds that of active duty military and veterans. Although PTSD is more prevalent in the military, the number of civilians with PTSD still tops the number of veterans with that condition. With the increasing occurrence of national and societal traumatic events around the world, including COVID-19, civil unrest, and climate change, there is mounting concern of an increase in PTSD and burden in the civilian population. As such, the current cost estimate is likely an underestimation, given that recent global traumas, the effects of which would not have been captured and are likely to result in increasing negative repercussions. The researchers also found that women represented 66% of the overall and 74% of the civilian population with PTSD, thereby contributing disproportionately to the national cost. Research has shown that trauma-exposed women show higher levels of PTSD symptoms than trauma-exposed men. Plus, trauma such as sexual assault and domestic violence tend to affect more women than men and represent important areas for prevention and treatment.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I want to get at another looming crisis that could be the number one cause of death by 2050, and that's antimicrobial resistance due to the overuse of antibiotics, which is both in animal agriculture and in medicine. And this story deals with the human medicine component. this from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy from the University of Minnesota. Study finds disparities in improper antibiotic prescribing. When the researchers broke down the data on inappropriate prescribing, they found that nearly three-quarters of the antibiotic prescriptions, 74% written for patients 65 and older, were inappropriate. They also found high rates of inappropriate antibiotic prescribing for all black patients, 64%, Hispanic patients, 58%, and men, 58%. The most common reasons for inappropriate antibiotic prescriptions were non-bacterial skin conditions, viral respiratory tract infections, and bronchitis. The study provides more evidence that rates of inappropriate antibiotic prescribing in U.S. outpatient settings may be even higher than previous studies have indicated. Among the most widely cited studies is a 2016 CDC published in JAMA that found that about 30% of oral antibiotics prescribed in U.S. outpatient settings are not necessary. But subsequent studies have found rates higher than 40%. And this new study indicates that inappropriate prescribing is even higher in certain demographic groups. That suggests U.S. outpatient antibiotic stewardship efforts have a long way to go. Our results underscore that strategies to reduce inappropriate prescribing must be tailored for outpatient settings. So beyond being medically unnecessary, it's not good for the patient. The public health interface here is that doing unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions leads to antibiotic-resistant pathogens floating around the world, which of course feeds back again into the medical care setting with multiple drug-resistant pathogens. Okay, well, next up I want to do another medical care story, and that one was about inappropriate antibiotic use, but there's also overuse, plenty of overdone procedures and stuff in healthcare. For instance, there's a lot of nosocomial infections, mean hospital-acquired infections. You get sepsis, a blood infection, and it kills lots and lots of people, thousands and thousands of people every year. Well, this next story I wanted to deal with CAT scans. This was triggered by a couple stories that are reported on with CAT scans where there was dyes that were injected that were having shortages during the pandemic. And I wanted to ask the question, is less CAT scans even better? And through this analysis, you will see that, in fact, CAT scans cause about 40,000 cancer deaths a year induced over time, and that's similar to what breast cancer deaths are on an annual basis. So let's listen in to this analysis. First of all, there's 80 million plus CAT scans that are done each year in the U.S. That's the most common scanning that's done. And the important thing about CAT scans is CAT scans use ionizing radiation, which is dangerous. And about 25% of these CAT scans are considered unnecessary. So with that context, I'll read a paragraph from the FDA page talking about what are the radiation risks from CT, that is CAT scans. This is from the FDA. The risk of developing cancer as a result of exposure to radiation depends on the part of the body exposed, the individual's age at exposure, and the individual's gender. For the purpose of radiation protection, a conservative approach that is generally used is to assume that the risk for adverse health effects from cancer is proportional to the amount of radiation dose absorbed, and that there is no amount of radiation that is completely without risk. This conservative approach is called the linear non-threshold model. The amount of dose depends on the type of X-ray examination. A CAT scan examination with an effective dose of 10 millisieverts may be associated with an increase in the possibility of fatal cancer of approximately one chance in 2,000. And this is sort of in the middle. There's depending where you do the scan and stuff, the amount of radiation you get. But this is sort of in the Midland ballpark and for some of the most common CAT scans, this would be representative. So they're saying approximately a 1 in 2,000 chance of a fatal cancer from a single CAT scan. Okay, this increase in the possibility of a fatal cancer from radiation can be compared to the natural incidence of fatal cancer in the U.S. population, about 1 chance in 5, which equals 400 chances in 2,000 over a lifetime. In other words, for any one person, the risk of radiation-induced cancer is much smaller than the natural risk of cancer. I'll talk about natural in a sec. If you combine the natural risk of a fatal cancer and the estimated risk from a 10 millisievert CT scan, The total risk may increase from 400 chances in 2000 to 401 chances in 2000. Nevertheless, this small increase in radiation-associated cancer risk for an individual can become a public health concern if large numbers of people undergo increased numbers of CAT scan screening procedures of uncertain benefit. Okay, well, this is a really good example of it's very hard to understand risk, particularly when you're talking these kind of small things like 1 in 2,000 doesn't seem like very much. But like they're saying, when you do large numbers across entire populations, the numbers start getting significant. But I think they made a real mistake here in combining this so-called natural risk, which would be the sum of all causes of cancer, which is far from natural. And of course, that's about 400 out of 2,000, a 1 in 5 chance over your lifetime of getting a fatal cancer. But if you're comparing, for instance, this CAT scan here with 10 millisieverts, kind of a representative CAT scan, that amount of radiation is equal to 2 or 3 years of background radiation, which is really what the primary natural radiation that you're getting from both the sun and from the earth, which radiates small amounts of radiation that you're being hit with all the time. So one CAT scan would be the equivalent of a couple years or so of background radiation. Now, remember, we're doing 80 million of these a year, so it adds up really fast. Okay, well, let's take a look at that. So this is from the CDC, an update on cancer deaths in the United States. What were the leading causes of cancer deaths in 2020? Lung cancer was the leading cause of cancer death, accounting for 23% of all cancer deaths. Other common cancer deaths were cancers of the colon and rectum, 9%, pancreas, 8%, female breast, 7%, prostate, 5%, and liver, 5%. Other cancers individually accounted for less than 5% of cancer deaths. So in 2020, 136,000 people died of lung cancer, about 52,000 people died of colorectal cancer, about 47,000 people died of pancreatic cancer, about 42,000 people died of breast cancer, about 33,000 people died of prostate cancer, and about 28,000 people died of liver cancer. Okay, so if you take this 1 in 2,000 chance of a fatal cancer, and you multiply that by 80 million per year, this 1 in 2,000 lifetime cancer risk, that means these 80 million CT scans would cause about 40,000 fatal cancer deaths a year. Now, of course, the death that it doesn't cause the death in that year, it causes it some future time, but over time, the cumulative effect. And that is hardly insignificant. If you're looking at 40,000 deaths per year caused, that's similar right now to what breast cancer is at 42,000 and more than what prostate cancers deaths each year there are at about 33,000. So hardly insignificant. So if you're getting a CT scan, ask your doctor if it's completely necessary and if there's other scans that are less invasive, meaning not having ionizing radiation, that perhaps could be done. Of course, remembering that about 25% of the CT scans are considered medically unnecessary. And, of course, CAT scans do provide valuable diagnostic information, but buyer beware and prudence may be advised. You are listening to Just for the Health of It. This is a greatest hit show, number 10. You're listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's switch gears, no pun intended, but we're going to be moving on to traffic deaths, a leading cause around the world and the leading cause of children and young adults worldwide. And the U.S. doesn't do as well as comparable countries. This first one from Science Daily. Up to 540,000 lives could be saved worldwide by targeting speed and other main areas of prevention. A new series published in The Lancet highlights a growing problem of road traffic injuries and lays out some opportunities for preventing injuries and saving lives. The series came at the same time as the United Nations General Assembly launched a high-level meeting on global road safety. The series offers a comprehensive analysis of that rising public health threat. An estimated 1.3 million people worldwide lives and more than 50 million are injured or disabled as a result of road traffic injuries every year. And this is the number one leading cause of death worldwide for ages 5 to 29. Researchers studied four road safety risk factors: speed, drunk driving, helmet, and seatbelt use. They found that full implementation of already proven road safety interventions targeting those four main areas could save up to 540,000 lives around the world each year. In the United States, a total of 43,000 lives could be saved by focusing on those four road safety areas, including more than 22,000 lives saved by restricting speed and more than 5,100 with interventions on drunk driving. Another 14,000 could be saved by better use of seatbelts and 2,400 lives saved by using helmets. So the bottom line here is 84% of potential lives saved from road traffic changes could be done through restricting speed and using seatbelts. So it's not some great new technology or method. It's been around for a long time. Speed kills, and not using a seatbelt leads you to a greatly increased chance of severe injury or death. And next up, highlighting how we're not doing such a great job on that front of medical crashes, this from Medical Express. United States has highest motor vehicle crash mortality rate in 2019. The United States has higher population-based, distance-based, and vehicle-based motor vehicle crash death rates compared with other high-income countries, according to a research published by the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. The researchers found that in 2019, the United States had the highest population-based death rate among the 29 high-income countries, which was 2.3 times the average rate of the other 28 countries. This population death rate in the United States for traffic deaths is 11 per 100,000 population, and translated to Lucas County's population, that'd be about 50 deaths a year. The 2019 U.S. distance-based death rate was 21% higher than the average rate among 20 other countries. From 2015 to 2019, the population-based death rate increased 0.1% in the United States, whereas the average change in the other 27 high-income countries was down 10%. So while we're staying the same, the other high-income countries are actually improving their safety on the roads. So one of the big things here about our culture is that we travel a lot more miles. So we're a little bit higher, 21% higher per mile, but when you add it up all together, we're driving a lot more miles. So it's a lot higher here than in other industrialized countries. And an often underappreciated effect of burning all those fossil fuels is simply air pollution, which causes all kinds of health problems. This from the Washington Post. Cutting air pollution from fossil fuels would save 50,000 lives a year. Eliminating air pollution caused by burning fossil fuels would prevent more than 50,000 premature deaths and provide more than $600 billion in health benefits in the United States every year, according to a new study by University of Wisconsin-Madison researchers. Published in the journal GeoHealth, the study reports that considerable health benefits of removing from the air harmful fine particulates, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxides produced by electricity generation, transportation, industrial activities, and building functions such as heating and cooking. Highway vehicles make up the largest single share. Okay, next up, let's move to another environmental issue, which is actually stress and mental health. We often think of mental health as what happens between our ears, but in fact, stress and all kinds of social and environmental conditions impact on mental health, and this next story from WalletHub gets at one of those and talks specifically about Toledo and Ohio. The most stressed U.S. cities, according to WalletHub. For the list, researchers compared 182 U.S. cities, including the 150 most populated cities in the country. They assessed at least two of the most populated cities in each state. Researchers looked only at the city proper. They did not factor in the surrounding metro areas. To calculate the rankings, researchers examined 40 relevant metrics across four key indicators: work stress, including average hours in the work week, job security, traffic congestion, and income growth; financial stress, including median annual household income, median credit score, poverty rate, and affordability of housing; family stress, including separation and divorce rates, share of single parents, and costs of child care; health and safety stress, including the percentage of adults in fair or poor health, metrics of mental health, the insured rate, and the crime rate per capita. Well, folks, again, Ohio did not fare very well. But who fared the worst in Ohio and the nation? Cleveland, ranked as the number one stress city. And who gets second place in Ohio? Toledo, coming in number 10th out of these 182 cities and the 150 most populated cities in the country. Ohio did not fare too well at all. Other cities ranking in the bottom third. Akron was 16th out of the 150 most populated cities. Cincinnati, 21, and Columbus, 47. So there you go. We round out the top 10 of most stressed cities in the nation. Okay, well, next up, want to move to some reasons why people have difficulty accessing mental health care. In this story, particularly young people. This from MedPage Today. Reasons why most young adults sweep depression under the rug. Over the last decade, more than half of young adults with depression reported not receiving treatment, and important reasons were related to cost and stigma. Cost of care was the most common problem for young patients with major depressive episodes, and the frequency of cost being cited as a barrier to mental health care going up from 51% in 2011 to 55% in 2019. During that period, the proportion of young people saying that they had inadequate insurance for treatment also increased from 7% to 16%. Other barriers to care included people not knowing where to go for treatment, worrying about confidentiality, not wanting to take medication, and not having the time. Of course, this is no real great news that cost is the biggest barrier and bottleneck to receiving mental health care services. This might be advantaged by getting universal health care consistent for everybody, and hopefully we could do it with parity between physical and mental health issues. Okay, well, next up, another mental health story. We learned early in this episode that law enforcement is spending more money dealing with mental health than all other domains combined, and there is an alternative. This story. A new study shows benefits to dispatching mental health specialists in nonviolent 911 emergencies. As U.S. cities rethink the role of law enforcement in nonviolent 911 emergencies, new Stanford research uncovers the strongest evidence yet that dispatching mental health professionals instead of police officers in some instances can have significant benefits. The study of a pilot 911 response program in Denver, in which mental health specialists responded to calls involving trespassing and other nonviolent events, finds a 34% drop in reported crimes during a six-month trial. The study by Stanford scholars Thomas D. and James Pine also shows that the direct costs of the alternative 911 approach were four times lower than police-only responses. We provide strong, credible evidence that providing mental health support in targeted, nonviolent emergencies can result in a huge reduction in less serious crimes without increasing violent crime, says D., a professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Education and a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. In our politically divisive times, Dee says, this first responder innovation provides a rare opportunity for consensus on meaningfully improving public safety and health. Several cities, including New York, Austin, San Francisco, San Mateo, California, and Washington, D.C., are experimenting with new ways to respond to certain types of mental health emergencies through little or no law enforcement involvement. According to Dee and Pine, cities have been motivated by not only high-profile cases of police brutality, but also estimates that police spend more time responding to low-priority calls than any other type of emergency. Those estimates, they write, suggest that as many as two-thirds of these types of 911 calls could be directed to mental health experts. Let the police do what they're supposed to do, defund the rest, and move those resources to actual mental health service providers. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears and talk about abortion in the global context. This is from a World Health Organization fact sheet on the status of abortion care worldwide and the standards for care needed to deliver good abortion care. Around 73 million induced abortions take place worldwide each year. 6 out of 10, or 61%, of all unintended pregnancies. and 3 of 10, 29% of all pregnancies end in induced abortion. Comprehensive abortion care is included in the list of essential healthcare services published by the World Health Organization in 2020. Abortion is a simple healthcare intervention that can be effectively managed by a wide range of health workers using medication or a surgical procedure. In the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, a medical abortion can also be safely self-managed by the pregnant person outside of a healthcare facility, for instance, at home, in whole or in part. This requires that the woman has access to accurate information, quality medicines, and support from a trained health worker if she needs or wants it during the process. Comprehensive abortion care includes the provision of information, abortion management, and post-abortion care. It encompasses care related to miscarriage or spontaneous abortion, induced abortion, the deliberate interruption of ongoing pregnancy by medical or surgical means, incomplete abortion, as well as fetal death. The information in this fact sheet focuses on care related to induced abortion. When carried out using a method recommended by WHO, appropriate to the pregnancy duration, and by someone with the necessary skills, abortion is a safe healthcare intervention. However, when people with unintended pregnancies face barriers to attaining safe, timely, affordable, geographically reachable, respectful, and non-discriminatory abortion, they often resort to unsafe abortion. Global estimates from 2010 to 2014 demonstrate that 45% of all induced abortions are unsafe. Of all unsafe abortions, one-third were performed under the least safe conditions, that is, by untrained persons using dangerous and invasive methods. Developing countries bear the burden of 97% of all unsafe abortions. More than half of all unsafe abortions occur in Asia, most of them in South and Central Asia. In Latin America and Africa, the majority, approximately 3 out of 4, of all abortions are unsafe. In Africa, nearly half of all abortions occur under the least safe circumstances. Each year, 5 to 13% of maternal deaths can be attributed to unsafe abortion. In developed regions, it's estimated that 30 women die for every 100,000 unsafe abortions. In developing regions, that number rises to 220 deaths per 100,000 unsafe abortions, or over 7 times higher. Estimates from 2012 indicate that in developing countries alone, 7 million women per year were treated in hospital facilities for complications of unsafe abortion. Multiple actions are needed at the legal, health system, and community level so that everyone who needs abortion care has access to it. The three cornerstones of enabling environment for quality comprehensive abortion care are respect for human rights, including a supportive framework of law and policy, the availability and accessibility of information, and a supportive, universally accessible, affordable, and well-functioning health system. Wonder what that might be. Let's see. A well-functioning health system implies many factors, including evidence-based policies, universal health coverage, a reliable supply of quality, affordable medical products and equipment, that an adequate number of health workers of different types provide abortion care at a reachable distance to patients, the delivery of abortion care through a variety of approaches, for example, care in health facilities, digital interventions, and self-care approaches, allowing for choices depending on the values and preferences of the pregnant person, available resources, and the national and local context. That health workers are trained to provide safe and respectful abortion care, to support informed decision-making, and to interpret laws and policies regulating abortion. That health workers are supported and protected from stigma, and provision of contraception to prevent unintended pregnancies in the first place. Availability and accessibility of information implies provision of evidence-based comprehensive sexuality education and accurate, non-biased, and evidence-based information on abortion and contraception methods. Yikes. Well, folks, by that definition, we are very far away from a well-functioning healthcare system, particularly in regards to abortion and the availability and accessibility information, particularly related to abortion and what is needed to prevent abortions, evidence-based comprehensive sexuality education, for instance. We are doing a very poor job in this country. Okay, and riffing on that last point, this next story from Medical Express, set them up for failure. Sex education not required in many states where abortion is or will be banned. Close to half of the roughly 24 states where abortion is or will soon be outlawed or heavily restricted do not require sex education. Most of those states require any schools that do choose to teach sex education to emphasize abstinence as the main or only way to avoid getting pregnant. Also, none require teaching about contraception. In contrast, in states with broader access to abortion, nearly all require sex education. Still, sex education tends to be limited even in those states, with many stressing an abstinence-only approach or making lessons on topics such as contraception and relationships optional. Very few young people in the U.S. get outstanding sex education, said Leslie Cantor, a professor and sex education expert at Rutgers University. To leave young people without information about birth control suddenly in this context, where they cannot legally get an abortion in half the states, that is an incredible human rights violation. Researchers and advocates said variations in sex education across different states could contribute to more girls and women being forced to take unwanted pregnancies to term. Teen pregnancy rates have declined in the past few decades, but some experts worry the new laws could force them back up. Sex education, which can vary not only from state to state, but also school to school within the same district, is essential for teaching young people about the laws and rights they have, particularly as abortion laws change, said Chris Harley, president and CEO of the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, an advocacy group for comprehensive sex education. The outcomes of sex education vary depending on what young people are taught. The science shows that abstinence-only education doesn't work, Harley said. By excluding other strategies for preventing pregnancy, what you do is you set students up for failure. You set them up for having more adverse sexual health outcomes. Researchers have found promising results when schools teach comprehensive sex education, which typically focuses on various aspects of sexual health such as relationships and consent, and discusses abstinence in addition to alternative strategies for pregnancy and sexually transmitted infection prevention. One 2008 study found adolescents who received comprehensive sex education were significantly less likely to become pregnant as a teen than their peers who received no sex education. The same study also found no significant difference in teen pregnancy rates among adolescents who received no sex education and those who were taught abstinence only. There are grave disparities in who receives what type of sex education based on gender, race, and class, research shows. Advocates worry the overturning of Roe will only widen these disparities. The combination of restricting access to information and healthcare could create trauma, harm, and misery that are going to devastate large proportions of America, especially in the South and in rural communities, said Harley of the Sexuality Information Education Council. Sex education is in the crosshairs as much as access to comprehensive reproductive health, she continued. Young people are really going to suffer. The risks are amplified for certain groups. In a study published late last year, Rutgers Cantor and her co-author found notable gender and racial differences in the type and extent of sex education received. Using nationally representative data from surveys conducted between 2011 and 2015, and 2015 and 2019, the study found that, as has long been the case, girls were more likely than boys to be instructed to wait until marriage. The double standard is alive and well, Cantor said. We are trying to raise young girls to be the gatekeepers of sex, and we're raising males to try to get sex. Cantor and her co-researcher found other inequities as well. Close to 0% of young people who exclusively receive sex education through the church learned about birth control, for example. And Black and Hispanic male students were less likely than their white counterparts to have learned about condom skills and birth control before having intercourse for the first time. One reason could be that students of color are far more likely to attend poorly funded schools that lack the resources to provide quality sex education. Some educators who support comprehensive sex education said they are worried about the challenges ahead with reduced access to abortion, but say their responsibility to teach sex ed comprehensively has never been greater. Okay, well, let's end this greatest hit show with a little something you can do for yourself. This from WebMD. 1 week social media break reduces anxiety and depression. Taking a week-long break from social media can lower feelings of anxiety and depression, according to a new study published in the journal Cyberpsychology, Behavior, and Social Networking. People who stopped using platforms such as TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for 7 days reported an increased sense of well-being, and some said they freed up about 9 hours in their week that they would have spent scrolling. Participants who took a break were more likely to agree with well-being statements such as, I've been feeling optimistic about the future, and I've been thinking clearly. They were also less likely to feel nervous, worried, or report depressive symptoms. So, if you need a little mental health break, consider taking a little sabbatical from social media. And another side effect of avoiding social media is being inundated with conspiracy theories, which brings us to our final segment, a parody PSA, one of my favorites. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Well, that does it for the greatest hit show number 10 for Just for the Health of It. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.